Welcome back to another episode of 1-2-3 All Ears on Me. I'm Kaylina Mills, and I'll be your host. It is now the beginning of March, and March is Developmental Disability Awareness Month. So today we are going to be talking a bit about disability in the classroom and children with disabilities. And we will be joined by Samara Cole Doyon, who was an early childhood educator herself and is now a children's book author. She is a local Mainer, and she is the mother to a child with a disability. She is going to share a bit about her experiences as a parent to a child with a disability and share her perspective on ways that teachers and policymakers can help improve the education system for children with disabilities to be more inclusive. But before we jump into the meat of our episode, I do have a reminder for everyone. The Connecting ECE statewide conference here in Maine is taking place May 3rd and 4th this year. It was originally scheduled for this past October and was postponed. And because of the postponement, you now have another opportunity to buy tickets if you missed out on getting them the first time around. If you don't yet have a ticket to the conference days in May, there are tickets available for both Friday and Saturday. You can find out more on our website, maineaeyc.org/conference. All of the registration information is there if you would like to purchase a ticket to attend this statewide professional learning event. Tickets in this resale are very limited, so if you want to get a ticket, please do so quickly. We anticipate they will be sold out very fast. So we hope to see you there in May, and now we will get into our episode.
Are you thinking about going back to school to get your early childhood education degree? Maine AEYC and the Office of Child and Family Services wants to make it happen for you. We are proud to facilitate the Teach Scholarship Program so that early childhood educators throughout the state can go back to school to get their associate or bachelor's degree with most expenses covered.
The Teach program is unique because it's a partnership between you, Maine AEYC, and your employer. Together, we all work to ensure that you can successfully meet your career and educational goals. If you get a Teach scholarship, Maine AEYC pays for 85% of your tuition costs, your employer pays for 7.5%, and you are only responsible for the remaining 7.5% of your tuition cost. For those seeking their associate degree, that's an average of only $260 per year that you must pay out of pocket.
Exactly, Tony. You can get your degree through the Teach Scholarship Program for very little money and without having to take out loans. It's such a phenomenal program to support early childhood educators throughout Maine. In addition to funding your tuition, Teach recipients are paid for 2 hours a week of release time so that they can study without losing pay from work or time from their families. The scholarship provides a stipend each term, and the scholarship pays for 85% of your book costs. The scholarship provides so much to its recipients.
And in addition to all of those benefits, Teach Scholarship recipients get one-on-one counseling and support from a Maine AEYC staff member to ensure that they can successfully complete their program.
It's so simple to apply for a Teach Scholarship. Go to maineaeyc.org/application and download the application to your computer. After that, it should only take about 30 minutes to fill out the form and apply.
Again, that's maineaeyc.org/application. maineaeyc.org/application. Apply for a Teach Scholarship today and get back into the classroom to get your degree.
Welcome. I am joined today by Samara Cole Doyon, who is a children's book author. She was a teacher. That's how I met her. We worked together in a school, and she is just a phenomenal human. And she's here to talk with us about disability and all of those things related to that. So, Samara, welcome.
Thank you, Kaylina. Thank you. I'm so glad that I get to be here and chat with you today.
Yes, thank you so much for being here. So before we jump into kind of the topic, why don't you introduce yourself to everyone and share a little bit about what you do?
Sure. So my name is Samara Cole Doyon. I am a children's book author. That's not what I was originally planning to do with my life. I went to school for English and for creative writing, and then I went back to school for education, and then I became a mother. And it became really important to me that my children had books that were empowering and representative of who they are, and also just, books that were kind of celebratory of the communities that they belong to. So that's how I ended up st starting this work.
Awesome. So, thank you for introducing yourself and joining us today. I'm like very excited to have you here because you're awesome. So March is Developmental Disability Awareness Month. There are several different disability awareness months throughout the year, but March specifically focuses on developmental disability, which is very relevant for early childhood educators that might be listening. And your latest children's book, Next Level, A Hymn in Gratitude for Neurodiversity, is coming out in April, which is so exciting.
Yes. I'm so excited.
Yeah, so what inspired you to write it?
So I sat down on a bench in Cape Elizabeth. I guess it was 4.5 years ago now, or 3.5 rather years ago now. It was 2019. I was a green public school kindergarten teacher, and my son, who is autistic and non-speaking and also has ADHD and whose body needs a lot of support to stay safe because he's just constantly finding himself dysregulated and seeking and needing input. He was just running around, and it was one of the few times that I was able to kind of sit back and watch him because my mom was there and my husband was there. And so, with our two children, usually between my husband and myself, one of us is on one of the children and the other one is on the other because, as I mentioned, my son needs a really high level of support just to kind of stay safe. And so I had this rare moment where I got to sit back and watch, and I pulled out my phone and started writing a rough draft of a poem that became this children's book. And it's really just it's just about the way that he moves. And for me, it's about acknowledging that other people may see him not speaking, see him communicating in a way that's really different and unusual, maybe even confusing to them. And they may feel uncomfortable. They may make assumptions about who he is and what he's able to understand and what he's able to do and who he is as a person. But that I know that he sees, I know that he understands those things. And I want him to know, I see you and I love you. So that's kind of the heart of the book.
That's beautiful. And I'm sure a sentiment many parents share about their own children.
For sure.
So I heard you mention, that your son is autistic, non-speaking. And before we kind of get into any further conversation, I wanted to ask about how you want us to refer to your son, to your family, because a lot of disability advocates have emphasized the importance of using identity first language. So, like saying an autistic person rather than a person with autism, or saying a deaf person rather than a person who is deaf. So that's kind of the general practice that I've heard from disability advocates, but obviously for individuals, it's a very personal thing. So, I want to know how you're speaking about your family and your son, so that I can use that language in this conversation.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate that. It brings to mind another advocate and teacher that I have been, and writer who I've been learning from over the past about a year, maybe a year and a half now, Tiffany Hammond. And something she said that really resonated with me is she said, "I have and I am." Because for her, she was saying autism is something that is both a part of who she is and is something that she has, and uses this language. She has a son who's speaking who uses the same language, "I have and I am," and a non-speaking son who I don't believe has yet indicated how he wants to be referred to, but that was really eye-opening for me because I think we live in a lot of spaces where it's like, this is the right way to say it, or this is the right way to say it. But it helped me to see that it's really what makes other people feel seen and heard and valued. And so I've taken that with me, and I say that to say I don't think there's a right way or a wrong way to address people except for what is validating and true for them. So anyway, I do use identity first language when it comes to my son being autistic because this is something that I know is part of just how his brain is wired and who he is. I don't think that's something that's going to, change, even if things change in the way that he presents over the course of his life. And maybe it won't be something that people can always immediately notice. It will still be a part of who he is. I use non-speaking. I'm starting to use that term because another advocate who I've run across, Danny Witty, he has this saying, I'm non-speaking but very verbal. And that was really powerful to me because it very concisely explains that here's a person who is incredibly articulate, is hyperverbal in some ways, and the way that he writes is just not speaking. So I think it's a little bit more specific than saying nonverbal, which is why I've tried to switch the way that I communicate that my son is not currently speaking, but he still has things to express through his body, through his communication device, and through pictures and so on. So I say non-speaking, and then I say that he is a child with disabilities, and I say that just because ability and disability is something that kind of ebbs and flows throughout the course of our life. No one is born being able to speak and walk and do all of those things, and those are abilities that oftentimes we can receive and also lose at different times. So I'm not sure that he'll always be someone who you look at and see disability, but I, right now there are certainly things, factors that are disabling. So that's a long way to answer. I say that I say he's non-speaking, autistic, and a child with disabilities.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, thank you for taking the time to explain that. I think that's really helpful for me, but also for our listeners who might not be as involved in, disability rights conversations as you
Totally.
are.
Totally. Yeah. I think it's important to have the conversations just so that, again, it's not really to me about like being right or wrong, but just about honoring people and what makes people feel seen and heard.
Now that we've kind of processed who you are and what brings you to this conversation, I'm interested in knowing a little bit more about your personal journey as a mother to a child with a disability and how that has affected or changed your life.
Well, obviously, it set me on this path of writing in a different way than I expected to be writing. I remember I had a roommate after college who told me that I should be a children's book writer. And I tell this story sometimes because I think it's funny now, but I like internally, I think externally, I was like, oh, okay, that's nice. But internally, I was like, how dare you? How dare you? Because I thought that my writing was, that it was so gritty and that it was so like visceral and that it was just, the deep, heavy stuff that should be taught in universities and not in elementary school. And then, obviously becoming a parent has changed my life, has changed my understanding of the world, has changed my focus. Becoming a parent to these specific children, to my children, has shifted everything for me. My son particularly, I worked with children with disabilities before I had my son. I worked with autistic children and children with lots of different neurotypes and abilities and disabilities, but there was nothing, it didn't compare to me to having a child who other people saw very differently. other people felt uncomfortable with, but who I could see had this incredible sense of humor, has this incredible sense of humor, is very sensitive, is very affectionate, is very bright and very creative, and is also non-speaking and doesn't not have control of his body, isn't able to keep his body safe or always do things that he wants to do with his body. And so I think, even though I understood that, you know, these children that I worked with were human beings with like a whole complex range of emotion and thought, I understood all of that, but I didn't fully understand how incredible a human being could be anyway to begin with. But then to have this child be my child and to see a little bit of the world through his eyes, it just really changed who I was. It changed my ability to see other people. It changed my ability to even see and understand disability, limitation, quirkiness inside myself. It opened up a whole new level of acceptance and appreciation and embracing that I didn't have before.
You're so beautiful when you talk and write.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
I just can't get over it. I wish I was as, you know, poetic as you when I was speaking. Yeah. And so
sometimes it comes out like a mess, but anyway.
Yeah. So those are kind of those gratitudes that I think probably are included in your upcoming book. You know, it's called A Gratitude for Neurodiversity. So I imagine those and similar things come up in it. Are there any challenges or barriers you've faced as a mother to a child with disability?
Yeah, for sure. Again, this is a thing that I didn't really realize. I did not fully think about it until we were navigating those systems of education and healthcare and just trying to access the community. I didn't realize how difficult it was going to be. Another thing that Tiffany Hammond said recently that I've been thinking about, I think I just saw it maybe last night or the night before, but she said that that we emphasize the way acceptance works. We emphasize sort of accessibility and all of these things. And those things are important when you're trying to share about how disability functions in your life, because community is a huge part of that and accessing community is a huge part of that. But she also brought up the fact that disability is going to be there whether or not community is acceptable and accepting and all of those things. So I want to acknowledge that, you know, whether or not the community is there to support us, my son is still not going to be able to speak right now at this point in his life. He's still not going to be able to, you know, open his mouth and tell me exactly what's going on in his body. He's still not able to keep his body safe in the sense that, you know, if he's, especially if he's feeling dysregulated, you know, there are times where he punches or kicks holes in the wall. There are times where his head has gone through like glass pane. There are a lot of factors that are just, they're going to be there and that we're going to have to navigate. And I think that accessibility to community is one of the things that makes it so difficult, or the lack of accessibility to community, to education, to healthcare. I didn't realize how isolating this experience was going to be, because I just didn't know how little people knew about, disability and neurodiversity. I'll give you an example. I mentioned that it's really difficult for him to keep his body kind of safe. There was a time when I came home from picking him up, and at this point, I had to drive him myself an hour away to school to drop him off and pick him up, because he was not a public school age. He was still a preschooler. And so, you know, there was no public school transportation for him. I was driving him an hour to school and an hour back. I got home and needed to go to the bathroom really badly. So I got the kids inside, but I forgot to lock our door. We have an inside lock on our door because Cohen has what we would call an elopement compulsion. Like he just needs to move his body. And sometimes that looks like running out the door and down the street, which is what happened. I was distracted. I went to the bathroom. I came out and I just couldn't find him anywhere. I couldn't find him in the house. I looked out back. I couldn't find him. It was raining, so I didn't think that he would leave, but he had left the house. He had run down the road. And by the time I caught him or caught up with him, he was running towards this road with four lanes of fast moving traffic. And this woman was trying to get him in the back of her car because she was trying to help. She didn't want him to be in an unsafe situation. She had called the police. It was a very traumatic situation for everyone. I think, one thing that would make it safer is if people just obeyed the speed limits near our house. I think people are not aware, even though we put out signs like children playing, please, go slowly. People still like zoom by our house, and he's almost been hit by, these large trucks coming by who just use our street to like try to cut around lights and stuff. And so, that's one thing, just the awareness, if there were public awareness of the fact that, there's a reason why residential areas you have to go slower, or, accessing medical settings has been really, really difficult. The sights, the smells, the lights. Cohen cannot sit in a waiting room, has not been able to access emergency room care. And so, and even public school, like, I wish that public schools were better funded and had the type of equipment that he really needs to stay safe. So, like, a very simple thing is having a playground that's completely fenced in. That's one thing that keeps him safe, and he has that at his school, but most public schools do not. And so he's not even in a public school because there's not the funding there to and the accommodations there to keep him safe. So, these are the things that I didn't realize we would have to think about as Cohen grew, that accessibility to medical treatment, to education, to the dentist's office, to parks, to restaurants and movie theaters. I didn't think that these were things that we would have to spend a lot of time thinking about.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I've thought about the playgrounds a lot when I taught public school. They're not, I've never worked in a public school that had a fully fenced in playground. And then also a lot of the times the paths to the playground aren't plowed. So if a child had a wheelchair or something similar, they wouldn't be able to access the playground. And just pieces like that where it's clear, even in a space like a public school that's supposed to be ADA accessible, it is often not designed that way. So, do you have any ideas of policies or laws that you would like to see implemented at the state level to improve the lives of children like Cohen and your family?
Yeah, I would love to see more funding go towards these issues of safety and accessibility. I would like to see our schools equipped with playground equipment and fencing. I would love to see public schools also just equipped with more staff and people who are, really trained and appropriately paid for the work that they do. I would like to see in medical settings, very, very much, I'd love to see more accessibility in the form of, first of all, information, second of all, policy, and just the way that information is shared. So, as an example, my son just recently had sedated dentistry, and that was a huge win for us. I was really afraid of this. Sedation was just so scary for us, but we met this incredible dentist in the process who seemed to, she had just joined the practice. The one that he was seeing had to leave the country kind of unexpectedly. And we had seen her a couple of times. And the first time we came to the office, I personally had a bit of a meltdown because I had tried to communicate to the office ahead of time. You know, Cohen cannot keep his body safe. He's going to feel very anxious in medical settings. He's going to be touching and grabbing everything, and it's going to be a lot for him. It's going to be a lot for me. I tried to communicate this ahead of time, but when we got there, and he was able to get into the room, which was huge, but then he was like running around and opening all the drawers, like very, you know, his body was like dysregulated and out of control. He was grabbing all of these things, and they're like, "Oh, he can't touch that. He can't have that." And I was like, "Well, I told you about this. These things they shouldn't be where he can have them then." And you know, they were like, "He's got to get in this chair." And I had this meltdown where I was like, "He is not getting in the chair. I don't know what you cannot see about this, but his body is not safe. He cannot get in that chair. I have been trying to communicate about this, and I need someone to like help us and meet him where he's at. We need accommodations." And so the dentist sort of like took a breath and adjusted her approach. She ended up sitting down on the floor with him where he was sitting and was able to like build a little bit of rapport, look at his teeth, and go from there. The dentist who ended up doing his sedated exam, however, who we were meeting for the first time, it seemed like she already had some background knowledge. She was already aware because she was like, "Hey, I want to work with you with your school," because they were working on a desensitization program and getting him used to like different medical tools, sights, smells, like letting him gradually get used to this, which is wonderful. Woodford's has been really wonderful and really helpful. She was like, let's work on this together. I will come in, like look at him in your car if you want. We can work up to him coming into the office." And so just having that awareness, just having that training and background knowledge, that makes a huge difference. That takes so much pressure off Cohen and off our family to have someone who's already like, "Hey, you don't have to," like, I didn't have to take it there to like this major meltdown. Like, she was already ready to meet us there and work with us. And so that makes a huge difference. So I think, you know, policies where people in the community have to access, you know, the dentist and the doctor's office and the emergency room. So if there are places that people need to access, and those professionals really do need the training and the knowledge, to interact with people.
Yeah, I'm thinking as you're talking, like maybe even a first step for a lot of these folks would be kind of like how teachers to get licensed have to take at least one class in quote unquote, teaching exceptional children. Like, and that doesn't solve everything. There are plenty of teachers who still don't understand or accommodate appropriately. That's an issue in and of itself, but it's at least a starting point where it's like you have to exposed to this. And so maybe like dentists and doctors and paramedics and firefighters, whoever, need a similar training as part of their, you know, licensing or however they get, you know, approved to do their job. That would at least be a starting place.
Yeah, I would love to see that. And then always, 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 it comes down to funding for me too, because nobody is going to be invested in that kind of training if they're not, you know, if they're not well paid. I think about like ed techs and BHPs and people who are asked to do so much work and are not really appropriately compensated. Even, you know, classroom teachers, when you think about the pay that you know, as we both know. But yeah, so I think funding is a way that we show what our priorities are. So that's always an important piece.
Yeah, absolutely. And like they do so much work, BHPs, ed techs, like you were talking about. And often they have the least amount of education and training in the room, right? Classroom teachers typically have more education and training than ed techs, for example. And yet, ed techs are expected to work with the children with the highest level of needs, typically. And so it's kind of backwards almost how we do it.
Yeah, I totally agree.
So, When you taught in the classroom, how did you prioritize inclusion for all kinds of learners? What are some strategies or lessons or activities that you used?
Well, I think, when I think back on that, when I think back on myself as a classroom teacher, I think, man, I'm not sure I could have been a classroom teacher the way that teachers are supported in the resources they're given with my son and all these other students in the room. Like, how would I prioritize everything? Like, what could I have made my classroom truly inclusive for everyone? I'm not sure. Here, like, some of the things that I found were helpful at times were including, fidgets, including areas that were like more sensory friendly in the room, including, things like a sensory play table. All of these things I think helped children whose bodies needed to move and to function differently. I remember having a student who like came in basically screaming every day, but it was just because she was so tired and she was like really dysregulated. And so we just tried to like create a space where she could kind of slowly adjust to being in the room and just like sit on a beanbag and cry for a little bit. And then I remember like by the I can't say the end of the school year because COVID hit and we weren't in the classroom at the end of the school year, but I remember a point in the school year where she would come into the room and be like, "Hi, Miss Doyon," and I was like, "Oh my God, this child has like grown so much in the course of this school year." But for my son, I'll say it's really helpful for him that there's only 5 kids, including him, in his classroom. It's a classroom with not a lot of overstimulation. It's a classroom where there's access to this really large, but not as large as a gym, like a gross motor room where he can literally rope climb and slam his body into things and swing and do all these things. All of those things are really important. So if I had like a limitless budget, or if I could create school funding, I would be like, this is what every school needs. They need places where kids can swing, climb, slam their bodies, get regulated before they're expected to do something like work on letter identification or learning to use their speech device or whatever is on the agenda.
Yeah, so adequate funding, adequate training, adequate spaces, and prioritizing meeting kids, behavioral, emotional, sensory needs before expecting them to do academic learning. Yeah, that's what I'm hearing from what you're saying. And, smaller class sizes too.
Absolutely, 1000%. I know 1000% is not a mathematical reality, but yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, because we both transitioned from teaching preschool to kindergarten at the same time, and I was 1 to 25 that year. Me alone in a room with 25 kindergartners, and it was insane. And I'm sure you can say the same thing. It's just too many kids, at such a young age for one person to work with. Let alone meet their needs 100%.
And then and teachers are expected to meet all of those individual needs, and there are just so many, and those needs are real and they deserve to be met. But teachers are real people with our own limitations. So that's not possible.
Yeah, it's like if you meet children's needs, learning becomes accessible to them. If you meet teachers' needs, learning becomes accessible to more of their students, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So I've heard you say some suggestions of, things that teachers could do in their classrooms. Do you have any other ideas of things that providers or early childhood teachers could do to better serve and include families like yours and children like Cohen?
Well, absolutely, I think being in conversation is really important. So one thing that has really been a game changer for our family this year is I reached out to Cohen's school and I said, we're having a really hard time with just getting Cohen to any kind of medical building, and this is more important to me than anything he learns. I'm just constantly afraid that something's going to happen to him and I won't be able to get him into a medical building. And this is what I need us to address. And they kind of blew me away by being like, absolutely, we're going to address this. But also they were like, look, let's meet every month. Let's just meet every month. And so his educational team meets with me every month and we talk about updates about where things are going, and it's a good place for us to talk about crossover between school and home and how we can be working on some of the same things, how we can be supporting him. And through this process, we have a couple of school support folks who actually come with us now to medical appointments so that
Wow.
they, as I'm talking, yeah, it's amazing. I literally just, I sometimes cry just thinking about it, but this way, I can be talking to doctors and they can be helping him to regulate. They'll be giving his body squishes. They'll be giving him things that he can look at and play with that help him feel more calm and safe. At the last sedated procedure that Cohen had, I was checking him in while my husband Matt and the behavioral specialist at Cohen School were like walking Cohen around in a wagon that the hospital had provided. They were pulling him around and like taking turns practicing with him the sedation mask that they like a practice sedation mask that they give to kids that they can it's smelly and is fun to play with. So like this was a completely different experience than it would have been otherwise. And yeah, I think just the ability to really listen and to respectfully include the concerns of families and children and to really address that, it's been incredibly life-changing for us. Yeah.
Yeah, I know it was not an easy road for you guys to find a program in a school for him that met his needs and accommodated him in the ways that he needed. So I'm really glad that he's found that. That's honestly incredible.
It really is. And I just feel that we're really privileged, which is sad because everyone should have access to these things. But, it's been a long road and there's been a lot of advocating, but I feel really lucky and really privileged that we've been able to work our way into finding these individuals at his school, with his doctors. We have a there's a behavioral specialist that we work with, and his pediatrician, I think, mentioned to us, or someone mentioned, you can have a behavioral specialist in addition to his PCP who can help, support you guys in ways to like make him feel regulated. And so, yeah, we've been really fortunate to find these individuals, these professionals who really care about their job and care about the people they're working with, and it's been really life-changing.
Yeah, and I think it all comes back to what you're talking about with funding. The people you're working with, I assume, are well paid and they have an environment, a professional environment where they can take the time to have meetings one-on-one with parents. They can take the time to go to a doctor's appointment with someone. They can take the time to learn about these resources so that they can share them with families, all of those pieces. It can feel really overwhelming for childcare workers or public school teachers when, like I said, you're 1 to 25 or you have just too much to do in a day. And so it's like, well, do I really have time to invest in this one thing? So having, the right staffing and resources to really invest in that makes a huge difference for the lived experience of real people.
It makes a huge difference. Yeah. So Yeah, again, I don't think, as a public school teacher, there's no way that I would have had the time to invest into individual students in the way that Cohen's teacher and behavioral specialists at school have had. And it's definitely the way the program is structured. It's the individual people, it's everything, So yeah, I think in an ideal world, we would really restructure the way that we do education and the way that we do even medical services. There would be a restructuring in the way we fund things and the way we train people. And that's what I would love to see.
Wouldn't we all? At least I would. I guess I can't speak for everyone, but
I know. I always assume that people like have the same values, but I think again, this is why, this is part of why the book that I wrote matters to me is realizing, people can't necessarily have, they're not going to have those values if they don't know what the situation is, if they don't know what people really need, if they're kind of, especially in Maine and maybe in a lot of places right now, we're all kind of in our own world, kind of dealing with our own situations, and there's not a lot of exposure sometimes to what other people are dealing with or what life is like or how no one's, if you don't know that these elements are existent, if you don't know that, well, public schools are really underfunded and there's not the support that families need, if you don't know that, if you don't see, oh, well, this isn't really safe the way that we have designed our playgrounds. Or if you're not thinking about those things and you're not going to care about it, it's not going to be on the front of your mind. So I think, sharing more about this is what it looks like. This is what our life looks like, in a way that's not, we're not, I'm not trying to say in any way like, everything sucks or whatever, but just there's a better way. And so I'm hoping that people will see more, will open their eyes more, will have more understanding, and that we can sort of build the communities that we need together.
Absolutely. So, change doesn't happen overnight, obviously. And like you said, it starts with exposure. You can't help make change if you have not been exposed to the fact that there's an issue. So, are there any resources that you would recommend listeners go check out to learn more about this?
Yeah, definitely. Over the course of the past couple of years, I have stumbled across a lot of advocates who are either autistic and or parents of autistic children, people who are sharing about their experiences, what was difficult, what was helpful, and have challenged me and have encouraged me to grow in the way that I think and in the tools that I use. So I made a list and I think I put links with them. And if I haven't sent it to you, I'm going to send it to you. But some of the people who have been really instrumental in my learning and growth have been Danny Witty, who I mentioned, it's a non-speaking autistic writer. Tiffany Hammond, she's an autistic parent of autistic children, also a writer and advocate. There's Tiffany Modeste. You can follow her and find her nigh functioning autism. There's Autistic Typing, Jules Edwards, who's an Indigenous autistic advocate. There's Happy Hands, but the H in Happy is spelled with a V. This is a non-binary autistic parent in Canada. And For the Love of Gabe, Nicole Goetzman, I think I might be mispronouncing her name, but she's shared a lot about her non-speaking autistic son and his kind of journey and some of the ups and downs. He's, I think, in public school, and so they've had some ups and downs with that, and she shares a lot about that. So anyway, those people have been really helpful for me.
Thank you. Yeah. And I will put all those links that you sent me in the show notes so people can access them if they want to check those out. And if people want to check you out and, get your books or hear more from you, where can they find you?
So I have a website. It's samaracoldoyan.com. And then my Instagram and Facebook pro I have some public profile. I have a public profile on each of those, and it's just Samara Koldoyan. You can find me pretty easily. I am a little bit on Threads, but I have not consistently. I'm just like getting so drained by social media lately. So I do try to get on there a little bit, but it's the past couple of years, I feel like I've just been finding myself on there less. But anyway.
You and me both. And then it became
Yeah.
my job. So,
Yeah.
yeah, but it is draining and you have to like regulate your time and make sure you're following people that are going to kind of inspire and fill your bucket. At least that's what I think.
Yep.
So awesome. So I will also share the links to Samara's website in the show notes. Her next book is coming out in April, but she has two others that are amazing. And you can buy those today. So thank you so much, Samara, for joining us. It was really lovely to get to chat with you, as always.
Thank you, Helena. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me.
All right. I'll see you soon.
Sounds good to see you.
As promised, Samara's information, as well as the resources she mentioned, will be in the show notes, but I really wanted to spotlight her two books that are already out and available for sale. Her debut children's book was called Magnificent Homespun Brown, A Celebration, and it's won a Coretta Scott King Award. It won the 2020 Lupine Award for Children's Literature, the 2021 International Literacy Association's Award for Primary Fiction. It was selected as the best of the best book by the Black Caucus of the American Library Association. It was on the Boston Globe's Best of 2020 Children's Books, the New York Public Library's Best Books of 2020, and a bunch of other awards and honors that that book has gotten. It is amazing and I highly recommend it. Samara's second book is called Magic Like That, and you can also get that on her website. So those are her two books that are out, and in April, her next book, Next Level, A Hymn in Gratitude for Neurodiversity, will be out, but you can pre-order it now as well, and that you can find on her website too. Hey, thanks for listening. You've just finished another episode of 123 All Ears on Me. This podcast is a production of the Maine Association for the Education of Young Children. You can learn more about us at maineaeyc.org. This podcast was recorded, produced, edited, and hosted by me, Kaylina Mills. Until next time.